This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. Consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh is in the studio today for his monthly show. How are you doing, Dr. Rajesh?
Very well, thank you.
So today we are going to be looking at an analysis that actually came out a few years ago. It's an analysis of the UK Clinical Practice Research Data Links database, which found that the risk of a child breaking a bone can depend on their ethnicity and where they live in the UK. Now, this one is interesting. When you sent it to me, Dr. Rajesh, and I have been aware of the importance of looking at socioeconomic factors in our lives within a certain population, and how those kinds of factors influence our health and well-being, sort of independent of the actual clinical condition, your state of health at a particular time. But it looks at somebody's life and across generations as well. But this one was interesting because I've never thought of it in the context of orthopedics, in the context of broken bones. So Dr. Rajesh is going to help us understand what this all means. If you have any questions, you can call us 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. So this UK analysis, let me just quickly summarize what were some of the key findings. They found that rates of broken bones were higher in white children compared to those among South Asian children and black children. There were also marked differences in fracture rates according to where the children lived, with highest fracture rates in places like Wales, north of England and Scotland, being higher than, say, Greater London or children living in the south of the UK. So what does all this mean, Dr. Rajesh?
Okay, people never think about the socioeconomic determinants of health when it comes to orthopedics. as you said, it just sort of completely blindsided you. And the reason why I picked this paper up is because it has sort of given a lot of granularity to a topic that we almost just take for granted. So let's go through the sequence here, right? In this country, who gets injured more often from an orthopedic sense? People who drive cars or people who ride motorcycles?
Motorcycles.
Okay. Of the social groups, the top 20, the middle 40 and the B40, which group rides the most motorcycles?
B40.
Exactly. Mm. Right. So it's almost like common sense, you know. But I think it's sort of the reason why is just because the way we view the world. I mean, there's this joke going around, some Matsali person's in a queue and the person's in front of him is very slow and he says, pardon me, I'm very sorry to trouble you. I know this might be frightfully inconvenient, but would you mind perhaps considering increasing the rate at which you're doing things? Whereas the Asian comes along and goes, move.
Hurry up.
And I think that's basically what the paper does, right? So in Malaysia, of course, there are socioeconomic determinants of health just like there are everywhere else. And you look at the people who walk into the emergency department, the determinants of health there are largely socioeconomic. Mm-hmm. Because if the only means you have is a motorcycle and you ride a motorcycle, you're subject to motorcycle accidents. Mm-hmm. I want to make the distinction between socioeconomic and poverty. Okay, so this is sort of a very, very important distinction. Malaysia, as a middle-income country, doesn't have poverty as a determinant for orthopedic health. And the reason is because we have such well-distributed orthopedic services throughout the country. Okay, mm-hmm. So let me give you an example. When I do my charity work and I go to somewhere like Sulawesi, I see children who have had a dislocated elbow. So that means they fell out of a tree and their elbow was dislocated and they had no care other than sort of the local bomo until they reached adulthood and then they got to the city and as a part of a charity mission, I'm there and then they got to see me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Doesn't happen in Malaysia. It doesn't happen in Malaysia.
Well, it used to in the, you know, 60s.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It did. But, you know, in the 60s, so let's look at University of Malaya. University of Malaya was the first medical school producing graduates in this country. So medicine in this country has got a very, very interesting history. If you look at it, medicine in this country, when it started off as in Western medicine, was basically a colonialist imposition, saying that we will provide for the local savages and we will bring our medicine, which is better than what they have. Okay. So what happened then was the colonial powers decided that they needed a cheap and deployable workforce. So they imported in doctors from the rest of the Commonwealth. But why did they import doctors in from the rest of the Commonwealth? It wasn't because they had particularly good matching cultural or socioeconomic norms. It's just because they spoke English. That was the common theme amongst the Commonwealth, right? Mm-hmm. So we colonized, you speak our language, you do what we tell you. Not to suggest I've got a strong anti-colonialist streak in me, but a lot of what we have is a legacy, right? Mm. So, and I think never more so in medicine. A lot of what we have is a legacy, and you need to understand the history before you can understand the present and the future. So initially, when we had orthopedic services, so let's look at Malaya, 1960. So Malaya, University of Malaya started, I think the first batch intake was 1960, 1961, somewhere around there. And even that was started by Professor T.D. Dhanaraj. So he was sort of one of the founding members of the faculty. Mm-hmm. And from 1960 onwards, there's an explosion exponentially of the availability of domestic healthcare services. Mm-hmm. So that means homegrown doctors going to homegrown locations, serving a home population. Now, it may sound a little bit unnecessary to emphasize that, but when you have an expatriate doctor population, it's not the same as having a domestic doctor population, because the way they serve is different, what they serve is different, their expectations is different. So when you have this sort of, in the 1960s, there were just no healthcare services available. And it's actually through structured planning of the country's healthcare services and the provision of distributed and equitable healthcare in the country that you've actually got healthcare services distributed throughout the country. Mm-hmm. So that's why I take pains to emphasize that poverty is not a determinant for orthopedic health. So somebody can be the child of an itinerant beggar on the streets of KL, fall down, break their wrist, go to HKL. They don't even pay a cent. They don't even pay one ringgit. And they get the same treatment as any other citizen of the country. So from an orthopedic sense, that's something that, you know, we can take great pride in, because poverty does not determine your orthopedic outcome. You know, it may determine your diabetic outcome, or it may determine some other chronic disease outcome, but it doesn't determine your orthopedic outcome. And I think that's something that we can be very proud of in this country, to say that for straightforward fractures, it doesn't matter whether you're poor.
Okay.
Right. The socioeconomic determinants of health come in when you start talking about the next highest level of orthopedic care.
All right. Which is?
Okay. So let me give you an example. So this sort of, it's very difficult to discuss in general terms without cases. So, you know, I'm going to talk about a lot of cases here. So one case that comes to mind is a girl. She must have been 9, 10, or maybe even younger. Yep. So say between 7 and 10. She was the pillion on a motorcycle in some low, middle socioeconomic income situation. And she wasn't wearing slippers or shoes. And
so she was barefoot?
She was barefoot on the back of a motorcycle. Mm-hmm. Now, if you've sat barefoot on the back of a motorcycle, when the motorcycle goes over a bump, your immediate reaction is to clench your thighs together to fall, stop falling mm-hmm. off the back of the bike. So what happens there is her heel went into the spoke of the motorcycle mm-hmm. and she had an avulsion of the whole heel pad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now there's a situation where you talk about the next level. Because in that situation, if the orthopedic services in the country were poor, she would have had an amputation,
mm.
right? Because that would have been the only treatment available to her.
Mm-hmm.
But she had appropriate primary orthopedic care at the district level hospital that she was at. So firstly, they went to a private GP clinic. The private GP clinic said, ooh, bad, go to hospital. Mm-hmm. So they went to hospital. Hospital said, let's tidy this up. Tidied it up, looked after the wound, and said, let me find you specialist care for this. She was then sent to the university hospital where I was training at the time. And we looked at it and said, okay, we can cover this with a cross-leg flap. That means that you take a piece of tissue from one leg and you cover the heel on the other leg, but you have to pin the two legs together with nuts and bolts and metal frames and all that. Okay. So this girl's ability to access that healthcare didn't depend on the amount of money that she had.
Mm-hmm.
The ability of the family to care for her did.
Mm.
Okay. So in that situation, it was sort of probably one of my most, jarring face-to-faces with the reality of the situation, in that the parents work, there is no extra social support, the child is in hospital by herself, I think like 2 months, something like that, while we looked after her. On the weekend, as soon as they could, they would rush to her bedside.
Mm.
And even then, one parent at a time, because they had the duties for the other children to do. Okay. So when you talk about socioeconomic determinants of health, people usually think about the accessibility that people have to expensive procedures. I can't afford an MRI, bad. That's not what we're talking about in terms of socioeconomic determinants of health. Socioeconomic determinants of health are basically, can you conduct your life and still access the healthcare that you need? Okay. So taking that statement in mind, the socioeconomic determinants of health doesn't then depend on how much money you have. It depends on your socioeconomic status.
Hmm.
So say, for example, somebody whose job it is to work at... So let's take this lady today. She's an expatriate. So she came to see me because she says, I have pain in my shoulder and upper back that goes on up to my neck. I work in front of a computer for 15 hours a day, 16 hours a day. That's the nature of my job.
Mm-hmm.
And given the current economic climate, I'm keen to keep my job. So let's look at the socioeconomic determinants of her health. Can she afford healthcare? Does she have the ringgit to be able to pay for healthcare that she needs? Okay. Second question. Is the healthcare that she can buy socioeconomically compatible to her situation? And that really is where the interesting conundrum is now. So the interesting conundrum, at least from sort of where I'm sitting at the minute, is that orthopedic healthcare has gotten extremely invasive.
Mm.
We cut people open quite readily in order to be able to achieve certain things.
Mm.
But, you know, somebody once said to me, the size of the solution is bigger than the size of the problem.
So the question is, should you be cutting people up?
No, the question is, what is appropriate orthopedic care? You see, so that's why when you talk about the socioeconomic determinants of orthopedic care, you have to look at both parts of the equation. You don't just look at the, won't use the medical, but you don't just look at the technical part of the equation. Okay, so you look at the part, you look at the equation and say, is this care appropriate for this person given their socioeconomic condition? And the social being prime, and the economic being subprime. Because with general healthcare services in this country, healthcare services are equally well distributed, that at the sort of most fundamental level, people are well covered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they really are. I mean, there are certain, I would say there are exceptions to the rules, there always are. Generalizations, there are exceptions to the generalizations, there always are. And some people have fallen horribly between the cracks.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the nature of a blanket system. It's not tailored for each individual. It is generally made for everyone. People always ask me, you know, who's sort of your most memorable patient, right? And my most memorable patient was actually derived from one of these socioeconomic encounters. It's a lady whom I saw when I was a trainee in orthopedics. I'd finished my specialist training, and it was one of my first few sort of specialist cases, and I was supervising some junior doctors. And one of them came to me with a little exercise book, one of the little 555 books. Mm. And in this 555 book, in different handwritings, were the diagnoses and the treatments which this lady had had for the past almost about 6 years or so. So the way it works in public services is you turn up to a public service, you're seen by the available doctor. The available doctor is usually a trainee, training to be a specialist. And then that person will take your history, do an examination, come up with a plan, and then go to see the boss. And so the boss will be looking after, like, you know, a whole bunch of different trainees. Otherwise, we can't get through a clinic of 100 people, 120 people. Of course. So when this little book was brought to me, I said, oh, this is interesting. This I must see. So I went to this lady. And this lady is standard 3 educated, right? So she's standard 3 educated. She must have been about her 60s by the time I saw her. But with standard 3 education, she can say, look, I don't know very much, but I know that every time I come, I have to see a different person. So instead of moaning and whinging and complaining about it like a lot of people do, she found a solution, which is I have my health record with me. My health record isn't a digital health record held on my IC, paid for by a multi-billion-dollar system for the whole country.
It's on a 555 book.
It's on a 555 book that she takes responsibility for,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's kept in a plastic, you know, it's hilarious. It's kept in a medicine pouch.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
So, you know, the sort of resealable medicine pouch. So it's kept in a resealable medicine pouch with a pencil inside.
That's cute. And regardless of whichever medical officer she sees,
yes.
that's continuity.
Exactly. That's continuity for her. So if you know, she's by far the most memorable patient I have because she basically took a stick to the socioeconomic determinants of her health from her perspective and just knocked it out of the park, right?
Mm.
So it doesn't matter that she was standard 3 educated. It doesn't matter that she had a low-paying menial job. The healthcare that she was going to receive is the most consistent healthcare that the system that she's in had to offer, right? Now, you contrast that to somebody who comes unprepared, without the medications that they're normally on, complain about the weight, and then say, lousy healthcare system.
Mm.
Okay, so when you talk about the socioeconomic determinants of health, you really have to look at the individual's responsibility in relation to the healthcare system, the individual's responsibility in relation to themselves, and then the healthcare system. Because the healthcare is an odd commodity. It doesn't obey the rules of supply and demand. There's no such thing as universal cover in healthcare, in my opinion, right? So, I mean, I'm sure there's going to be a bunch of healthcare economists sending some very angry tweets. But universal healthcare is an ideal. It is unachievable, and it's an ideal that we should strive for, but it is unachievable on the ground. Because there are always going to be exceptions.
Mm.
So to start a healthcare encounter with the mindset that we have universal healthcare and everybody's healthcare is provided for is a formula for disaster. It's like saying, I'm going to drive on the road at 100 kilometers an hour because it's a straight road and the sign says 100 kilometers an hour and I'm going to keep my eyes closed. Why? Because it's a straight road and the sign says 100 kilometers an hour. It doesn't work like that, right? So you have to be respectful of the barriers within a universal healthcare system. And you have to be aware of sort of the exceptions and the exemptions in those sorts of situations in order for people to be able to access appropriate healthcare.
All right. And it's interesting you brought up universal healthcare. I mean, universal healthcare, there's that term. There's also universal health coverage. And that term came up when the Ministry of Health responded to an article published in the journal Nature just a few days ago. And they were clarifying some misrepresentation in the Nature article and stating that we have achieved universal health coverage in Malaysia. And I wanted to try to understand a little bit more about that and also link it back to the study about the fractures in children so that we can better understand, you know, if in Malaysia poverty does not determine your orthopedic outcomes, But there are still factors in your socioeconomic status that may make it complicated for you or difficult or challenging for a family to be able to conduct their life, as you said, even after the treatment has been provided. So we'll come back and continue this conversation. There's a lot to wrap my head around. Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon, we're discussing socioeconomic determinants of health. If you have any thoughts you'd like to share, you can call us 03773 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. In the studio with me today, Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon. We're discussing the socioeconomic determinants of health, and we're looking at it from an orthopedic context. Our jumping off point was an analysis of UK database, which found that children of certain ethnicities, white children basically, had higher rates of broken bones compared to those amongst South Asian children and black children. The analysis also looked at where the children lived in comparison to the fracture rates. And in the course of our conversation earlier, Dr. Rajesh, you've talked a lot about understanding more about how the socioeconomic determinants of health, if we're looking at it in Malaysia, where our healthcare system and our services are well distributed and equitable, it may not, in an orthopedic context, it may not necessarily lead to poorer outcomes, but there are lots of other factors involved, if I understand this correctly. And, you know, you brought up universal healthcare and how that's an ideal that we should be aspiring for. But what in reality, it's often imperfect. And you know, the Ministry of Health responded to an article published in the journal Nature, in which it was misreported that we have poor state healthcare in Malaysia. And so the Ministry of Health responded and said that we with our state subsidized healthcare, we have achieved universal health coverage. So how do we understand this? Does that mean that, and I think I take universal health coverage to mean what you explained earlier. We have good services distributed across the country, regardless of where you live. But then how does that explain the example you gave where a girl from a poorer or lower income family who had the treatment that she needed for free, but it's what comes after her because of her family's employment, state of employment. They weren't able to even take time off work to take care of her. So where does this leave us?
Okay, so this is going to bite. Okay, so stay with me. You have to get very, very clear the allegation or the misrepresentation which is made in Nature. So firstly, why is it such an important why is it so important? It's so important because Nature is a very, very prestigious, very well-respected publication. And anything that is written in Nature is taken to be true unless otherwise stated.
Mm.
And the line in there which sort of caused the controversy was almost a throwaway line where apparently somebody had faced medical bankruptcy in Malaysia because of the cost of the health of their healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So now this is where the bite's going to come. I said to you that we have equitable distribution of resources. It doesn't mean that they're the best resources available or that the only resources available. The resources are equitably distributed so that the most people can enjoy the benefit of those resources within what it costs to provide those resources. So that's where the consumption issue comes in. Okay. So certainly I've heard of medical bankruptcies in Malaysia, but the medical bankruptcies in Malaysia are basically people choosing to consume healthcare. You see, this is where the bite is. Healthcare has become a discretionary consumer product.
As opposed to being a right.
Well, universality of basic human health is a right. Healthcare is now a complicated product.
Mm.
Okay. So let me give you an example of, let's take an analogy. Let's say the government says, we provide free food for everybody. We provide you with one glass of rice, one tin of sardine, and one fistful of whatever green and one piece of fruit for every citizen of the country. That is universal health care. That means everybody has some basic ration so that nobody starves. But people are free to eat what they like. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you may say, well, you know, I want escargot and caviar and sparkling champagne and whatever else you like, right?
Any luxury item.
Any luxury item. You can spend 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 ringgit on that meal. Whatever you feel like spending. And healthcare is the same. So now this is where it gets difficult, because somebody can say, I spent 10,000 ringgit on meals and I'm bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
But you can say, but the government is giving free food. How can you be bankrupt?
Mm. So you chose to spend.
Ah, yes. But you see, the question there is, you, if you didn't spend, were you going to die?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's where the real difficulty and complexity in the socioeconomic determinants of health come in. In the economic, the social is pretty clear. The economic is where it comes in, because people want different things. And healthcare has become a discretionary consumer product. People will decide what they want based on their particular social circumstances. People will say, I don't want a scar there. I want to look like this. I want to function like my friend over there. They make the decisions not just on health outcomes. They make the decisions largely on social outcomes. So you see what the problem is.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got the other side of the industry. So when you talk about healthcare, you talk about public healthcare and then private healthcare. When you talk about private healthcare, you talk about privately, personally funded and insurance funded. When you talk about insurance funded, then I start getting a little bit hot under the collar, because the stupidity is unbearable. Okay. So I'll give you a simple example. A lady comes in to see me with a clearly solvable problem where we take the socio-economic model, right? So socially, her problem is very clear. Medically, her problem is very clear. When I file for her insurance company to give an approval to do her procedure, I'm told, please provide an MRI.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in that situation, is an MRI necessary? It isn't, because the diagnosis is as clear as day. But when you start talking about the economics, because remember the topic here is the socioeconomic determinants of health, right? And then you say, well, why is the cost of healthcare going up? Most of the time, the media blames the doctor's charges are too high, the hospital charges are too high, the technology charges are too high. But look at the inefficiencies in the system. And those are the things that really make it very difficult to talk about equitable distribution in health when you talk about any healthcare system. Because let's look at the patient who has very little financial means, who got treatment at a government hospital that solved their medical problem. So for their socioeconomic situation, that result is perfectly acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's take somebody else whose social has a higher social need. They say, I need to look a certain way, I need to function a certain way, I have a certain sense of self that doesn't allow me to accommodate this treatment that would otherwise be offered.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Whose responsibility is that to pay for that treatment?
Personal responsibility.
Well, exactly. Mm. But that's the challenge, see? The challenge is, where do you draw the line? Do you draw the line to say that as a state, this is what we can afford, and so that is what we are going to provide for everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you say, as a state, we're going to provide what everyone wants as an individual? Well, in healthcare, the state can't afford that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or do you take a model where you have, as much as it pains me to say it, the Singaporeans have it perfect. The Singaporeans have the healthcare financing model perfect in what I can see.
Okay. Which is?
Okay. Which is, there are pools of money belonging to groups of people. And the powers that be have grouped groups of people and groups of monies together. And that socio-economic responsibility is shared. So let's say that you live in a household and that household has 5 members and you're all part of the same family. You have shared economic resources in relation to your health as a family. If one of that family member chooses to smoke, okay, then you have a decision. If they continue to smoke, then the premiums for the whole family goes up.
Mm-hmm.
If they stop smoking, the premiums for the family goes down.
Mm-hmm.
So what that does is it basically forces people to be responsible for their health.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody needs something done. They can have it done by technique A, technique B, or technique C. Technique A costs 50 times as much as technique C, gives you an equitable outcome, but gives you a scar. So you have to say, is the scar that I'm going to have medically or socially justified to consume this amount of resource, right? So the reason why I think the Singaporeans have got it right is because they've got this model to make people consider the financial aspects of their healthcare choices.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, I think, in Malaysia is both for the public and the private services, there is no reflection of the cost, and I don't mean the ringgit cost, I mean the social and equity cost of the healthcare that people consume.
All right.
Right. So that's why in this article in Nature, for example, you cannot say that the person chose to face medical bankruptcy, because nobody would choose to face medical bankruptcy. You can say that the person faced medical bankruptcy. Yes, that's the fact. But let's look at the circumstances in which the person faced medical bankruptcy. Is it the fact that they chose to have treatment which was known to be effective in that particular situation, but just not afforded in the national healthcare system? If it is, we have to be able to chin up and say, well, that's the reality. Medical science has advanced so far that if you had enough money, you could probably fix most things. But the reality is, it's not possible. Or do you say, well, since the state didn't provide it, I had to provide it for myself at the cost of bankruptcy? You know, so that's why that Nature article, when, you know, it was making the rounds on social media, and when I saw it, it did strike a raw nerve with me, because having trained within the sort of structure of the public health services in the country, I do have a great deal of empathy for the public health services in the country. Really, a lot of people are doing a lot of good work without sort of, you know, applause or acknowledgement. And that's just the way it's always been, right? So, you know, the policemen do it, the firefighters do it, the public health people do it, the doctors do it, the nurses do it, the teachers do it. That's just what we do. But nobody goes and says, my teacher didn't teach me well enough. I had to take out a big loan to go to a good university and get a good education.
Mm.
Right? But people will say that I didn't get adequate treatment within healthcare facilities of the government, so I had to spend money to get adequate treatment. And that's a problem. So that's why when you talk about socioeconomic determinants of health, it's very easy for somebody to stand up on a soapbox and make a lot of noise, because their point is valid. But it's very, very difficult to find a balanced voice for discussion when you talk about socioeconomic determinants of health. Because at the end of the day, it is a finite resource. And the finite resource has the additional issues of timeliness and distribution and social justice. And that's where it becomes a real problem.
So when we better understand the socioeconomic determinants of health, do we use them to target resources at prevention?
Okay, that would be ideal, right? So let's take the use of helmets, for example. So mm-hmm. that's been a success, resounding success story. In fact, it's so successful that you don't even think about it, right? It's just before the legal and compulsory use of CIRM-certified helmets, people are dropping like flies. You know, it's just head injury, boom, that's it, you're out. So that mortality has come down significantly. The compulsory use of seat belts, absolutely. But when you talk about budgets in healthcare, they don't come into factor, do they? Right. Mm. So you don't talk about the cost of implementing a compulsory use of helmet program in terms of a healthcare budget.
Mm.
You don't talk about the cost of, right? So this is the thing. The reason why the topic is so difficult is because you've got these social determinants and you've got these healthcare outcomes and you've got costs associated to both. So you would argue a dollar spent in prevention is worth a lot more than trying to fix somebody with a broken head from a motorcycle injury. Absolutely. But here's the kicker. On the flip side, when somebody does have an injury, the general rule doesn't matter anymore, right? It becomes a particular personal situation that has to be dealt with in relation to what the system is. And it's difficult, you know, it's something that I try and sort of put the topic all on one piece of paper and it's just really too big to look at it in one voice.
Mm.
And I think that's probably what I said, say that the socioeconomic determinants of health are really too big to look at one in one voice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, this same sort of argument came up when they're talking about car seats for children, right? It's the cost of installing a car seat for low-income families versus the value of saving lives. Mm. Your example about helmets just brought that to mind again.
Okay, here's the question. What's the value of someone who's living versus what's the value of someone who's not living?
Contribution?
Well, exactly. Mm. Right, so because it's an unquantifiable,
you can
argue what is the value in a ringgit sense, right? You can argue what is the value of somebody who has a job, generating revenue for the country and paying their taxes, but how do you calculate on a financial basis what the value of a life of a child is who's going to get tossed out of the car in the event of an accident?
That's a tough one.
It is a tough one. So that's, you know, that's the thing about this topic, right? Every time this topic comes up, it's just like, oh my God, brain melt. Because it is so multifaceted. It really is so multifaceted. And you sort of, one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. And it's sort of, it's almost the best, what's the word? The best summary I can put to it is what sort of a society would you choose to live in? So say, for example, would you choose to live in a society where people will come into your house and tell you that, no, it's not okay for you to eat with your hands because civilized people eat with forks and spoons? Do you know which country that is?
Where you are told that?
Yes. No. Currently in the world?
No.
Okay. If anybody knows, let us know. I do.
Okay, say that again.
Okay. So,
in which country?
In which country will healthcare officials come into your house and tell you that you have to use utensils to eat? You cannot eat with your hands because it is unhygienic and inappropriate.
Okay.
It's an actual problem with an actual Indian family migrant to a Nordic country.
Right.
Okay, so I've sort of let the cat out of the bag
there. That's all right, that's okay. I really wanted to know.
Yeah, because that's exactly what happened, right? So the question is, would you want to live in that sort of a society, or would you rather live in a society where you want to eat with your hand, eat with your hand, you want to eat with your fork, eat with your fork, you want to eat with your spoon, eat with your spoon, eat with your chopstick, eat with your chopstick, like you want to share your chopstick, share your chopstick, provided it's not it doesn't carry hepatitis. No, I'm serious. So, When I eat in Chinese restaurants, when I used to eat, when it was possible to travel in Chinese restaurants in Hong Kong, when I go for meetings, they have two sets of chopsticks. One set of chopsticks is to take from the common bowl into your bowl. Mm. And the second set of chopsticks is to eat from your bowl to your mouth. Right. And the reason is because in Hong Kong, that's it's recognized that sharing of chopsticks like that is a transmission route for hepatitis, the orally transmitted hepatitis. So from a public health perspective, they've already put that in place because it's a public health cultural cross-section, right?
Yeah.
Chinese restaurant in Malaysia, it's still, you know, everybody's chopstick going in.
Well, sometimes you get a serving spoon.
Yes, yes, sometimes you get a serving spoon, but the old-timers... who are still drinking their Guinness stout, want to, or maybe alcohol kills the bugs, I don't know. Cultural.
I'm having a bit of brain melt right now.
I told you. It's just you can't go anywhere without melting your brain.
No,
on
that's
this.
Because you brought up Chinese restaurants and chopsticks.
But it's because that is the intersection there is cultural
practice
in relation to healthcare. Mm,
yes.
Right.
And improving health outcomes, preventing disease.
Exactly. Mm. And so that's how complicated it is. So let's look at us. Okay, what can I say that's clinically relevant? So child comes in. So normal child, born normally, growing normally, has in-toeing. So that means that the foot is actually turned in one more than the other. And I say to the grandmother, to my detriment, that the child cannot sit cross-legged, because if they sit cross-legged, this particular problem will get worse, and, you know, it's for a few years. And the grandmother looked at me like I was diseased or demented. You know, what do you mean my child cannot sit cross-legged? How else is the child supposed to sit down and eat?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there, the cultural determinant is the child needs to be able to sit cross-legged, because everybody sits cross-legged on the floor and eat.
Mm.
So if the child, what, so we're going to put a special table for the child to sit down and eat?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that child's health, that child's orthopedic health outcome is going to be dictated not by my medicine. It's going to be dictated by the grandmother's social acceptability.
But as a clinician, can you look at each individual, look at their circumstances and say, okay, if that doesn't work for you, here's something that can?
Well, that's the quintessential definition of being a clinician. So because I was blindsided by that grandmother, I didn't expect that. To me, it was like just a simple, straightforward encounter, right? My backpedal was, okay, let's just try and see what happens. I'll see you in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that gives me 6 months to try and come up with plan B.
And have you?
That was just last month. No, I'm still thinking about it.
Yeah, okay. We'll revisit this in 6 months. I know this has been a huge topic, and really today was just an attempt to look at one small aspect of it. But do you have something that we can take away from this?
Okay, I think the takeaway, if the topic is the socioeconomic determinants of health, is that it's not about money.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the shared responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that would be the takeaway topic, that you have to, the minute somebody complains about money within healthcare, they're missing the bigger picture. See, I got two in one there.
Very good. You get a brownie point.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon. We've been discussing, you know, as you've guessed, socioeconomic determinants of health. But I think that's one conversation of many more that we can have. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.